Okay, good evening. Let's get started. Right, so tonight we're looking at the last in the series on the creation of humankind. And what we're really going to look at tonight is what went wrong. Because everything was going fine until now. And last time we learned about Lo Tov Heyot Adam Levado, the final completion, God looking at the Bria, at the whole creation and saying, it's not good that man is alone, and he creates woman. And with that finishes the perfection of the Bria, and we discussed some unusual approaches last week to what exactly happened in that process of the creation of woman and the extension of the creation to a whole new level. And everything seems to be set just perfectly. Everything's now ready to go, and it's Erev Shabbos. It's moments before Shabbos, and then the wheels come off. Then everything goes chaotic, as we know. The Nachash and the woman and the Eitz Hadas and the Chet and the punishment and everything just goes crazy. What happened? What went wrong? So we've got to try and identify the moment at which it went wrong and the reason for which it went wrong. What actually happened? So the beginning of the story of it going wrong is the end of chapter 2. Chapter 2:25. Perek Beis, Pasuk Chof Hei. And it's a very difficult two sentences. And ignore the fact that a new chapter starts with chapter 3, because as you know, the chapters are not Jewish chapters. They weren't put there by Chazal. And therefore there's not a lot of meaning in when a chapter ends and when a chapter begins. So there's no samach and there's no pay, there's no space between verse 25 of chapter 2 and verse 1 of chapter 3. So treat them as two sentences right alongside one another. Vayiyu shnehem arumim, and the two of them were naked, ha'odom v'ishto, man and his wife, v'lo yisboshoshu, and they were not ashamed. And that's how Unkelus translates it. They were, the two of them were naked, Adam v'Isa, v'lo miskalmin, there was no shame. The next sentence is, v'hanachash haya arumiko chaya sasode, and the nachash, the snake, was, and we see that same word, arum, but here it means something else. Here it means sly. But clearly the play on words is interesting. It's not for nothing that the same word is used, although it means something else. And the Ibn Ezra says it's just stylistic. It's just to draw attention. It's just to emphasize. It's a stylistic methodology to use the same word, even though it means something entirely different. So let's read it as it stands first and try. And that's the moment at which things begin to go wrong. We know the Nachash is the cause, and the Nachash is introduced with that statement of the two of them were Arumim. So let's understand what that has to do with what's been before. And we know that they are not ashamed here, and later on they become aware of their nakedness and they develop a sense of shame when they've eaten from the tree of knowledge. So let's just go back a little bit to the Eitz Hadas Tovara and to understand what it is and why God didn't want them to eat it. So firstly, clearly Adam and Chava were incredibly wise. The Ramban says that, and the Ibn Ezra says that. Clearly they were created. Firstly, Hashem wouldn't give commandments to beings that didn't have seichel, that weren't wise. Second, and couldn't make choices. Didn't have responsibility. Secondly, God brings all the animals of the world to him, and Adam defines the essence of every animal in the world. So this is not some naive being that doesn't understand anything. This is probably the wisest person that's ever lived. A man whose knowledge is absolutely clear, created by Hashem, given knowledge from Hashem. So Adam's knowledge was superb. So what was missing from there? What extra knowledge would they have got from the Eitz Hadas? What did Adam and Chava not know that they would have known from the Eitz Hadas could have given them? It's a strange thing called, this is the tree of knowledge, which isn't the right translation. You're talking about it in English as the Eitz Hadas, as the tree of knowledge. But in the Torah, it's Eitz Hadas Tovara, which is very important. It's the tree of knowledge of good and bad. And what does it mean? Adam and Chava didn't know what good and bad was. Then how would Hashem hold them responsible for disobeying him? If they didn't know what was good and bad, then they were just like children. You can't hold them responsible. So clearly they did know the difference between good and bad. So what does the Eitz Hadas add? What does the Eitz Hadas give them that they didn't know before? So the Ramban says in Perek Gimel Posuk Vov, the Ibn Ezra says, there's only one thing that the Eitz Hadas gave them that they didn't have before. And that is an understanding of how Tov V'ra is intricately embedded together in everything. That Tov V'ra are not two separate things outside, separate from one another. Everything has good and bad. That's the piece that they didn't have without the Eitz Hadas. So with them, everything was black and white. They could see something was good, something was bad. But to be able to perceive that in everything there is good and bad, that they weren't able to see. So if we look at Adam and Chava themselves, and we talked about that kind of paradox, the two polarities from which they're created with a divine soul, and they're created with an animal earthiness, and that's brought together in one being, but they weren't conscious of their animal earthiness. They thought like a divine being. So for them, they could see animal things outside there, and they could see nature, and they could see bad things, and they could see good things. But from their own perspective, they weren't conscious of themselves as a blend of material and spiritual. They felt spiritual, they thought spiritual, they were spiritual. So that was their greatness, that was their purity. And because of that, their nakedness was not an issue. They were not aware. There was nothing to be aware of. There was no consciousness. They were just aware of themselves having the capacity to procreate, to create life, and that was part of their divine mission. And that was just part of their purpose and the purpose of their creation. It wasn't something that they... In fact, it's in the area of intimacy that we have the most perfect or the most extreme and amplified example of good and bad coming together. There's nothing more important for the existence of the world than human intimacy, and there's nothing more destructive of human character than intimacy, and of society than intimacy. The biggest, most serious isurim are around intimacy, and the biggest mitzvahs are around intimacy. The same action, just under different circumstances. So the action of intimacy itself has within it the potential for unbelievable kedusha, and it has within it the potential for unbelievable destructiveness. So sexuality, intimacy, is the epitome of Tov V'ra coming together in one action, in one place. And that's why there's a relation there. And the Ibn Ezra says there in chapter Gimel, in chapter 3, verse 6, the Ibn Ezra says that's the piece they didn't understand. They were not able to understand that the power of human sexuality, not only for good but also for bad, in the same action, which leads also to an understanding of Chazal. If we look at the Rashi, for example, on Velo Yitboshashu, Shelo Hayu Yodim Derech Tzniut. They didn't know about Tzniut. Imagine that. Today they wouldn't have got their children into a Beis Yaakov. Well, your family, your parents don't know about snus. They walk around naked? Yes, because for them that was completely natural. Lo hayu yodim derech snus. They didn't know about snus. Because what snus is designed to do, snus in the big sense, not just snus in the sense of dress, but snus in the big sense is designed to establish or to focus on the kedusha of an area and eliminate the negativity. That's really what tzniut is for. So if you look at tzniut just in the simple sense of the word, so if you have a woman, let's say, who, like Adam and Chava, b'lahavdil, but for different reasons altogether, is not aware of tzniut, and she walks around in a very revealing but attractive way, what is she doing? So what she's doing is she's using the power of her own sexuality, which is a God-given gift, but the energy that it arouses out in society is not one of Kedusha. Because how can it be one of Kedusha? She's now wandering around with all sorts of all manner of people, and men who are not her husband, and men who are married to other women, and who have been given the power of attraction. That's part of what this all is. So you look at the power of attraction, positive or negative? Well, it's positive if there's tzniut. It's negative if there's not tzniut. The power of attraction itself, the power of intersexual attraction itself, becomes negative when there's not tzniut. When there is tzniut, it's incredibly powerful. So tzniut is designed to be able to focus a force such as, but it's not only for sexuality, it's in every area. Tzniut is really about diminishing the visible, the external visible parts of a spiritual action. That's really what tzniut is. It's in all areas of life. To de-emphasize the physical and to emphasize the spiritual. And that's why we've spoken before about the fact that in our Lithuanian tradition, there was such an emphasis on not doing anything that required any kind of external exhibitionism, unless it was really required by halacha. Everything was hidden, everything was quiet, and that's the beautiful story of the Hasidic Rebbe who sent, and I think I mentioned it when we talked about Lithuania, who sent emissaries to Lithuania to find out what the Jews in Lithuania are like. In those days, there wasn't a lot of communication between Hungary and Lithuania and Poland and Lithuania because of the political tensions between those countries. And the guys came back, the emissaries came back and said, they look like goyim and they daven like angels. And that's such an absolute perfect description in a sense. They look like goyim, not like prosta goyim, they look like the most elite of the goyim. That's how they dress, that's how they position themselves. You couldn't tell them apart. There's a beautiful piece in a biography written by the Torah Temimah, where he talks about his time and he talks about his family. It's a most beautiful book, the Makor Baruch. And one of the stories he tells there is of an uncle of his, if I remember correctly, or a great uncle of his, being terribly upset. He was visiting in Paris, and he went to the Rav in Paris and asked where he could eat. And the Rav gave him the name of a restaurant. So he went to the restaurant, and he ate, and the food was delicious. He had some chicken, and it was absolutely delicious. So he calls the waiter over, and he says, I'm going to be here on business for a few days. I'm going to be eating here every day. This is what I want. Don't do anything different. What you gave me today, give me every day. It's just perfect. The waiter says, fine. Comes the next day, and he has what to eat, and it's just not as good. It's chicken, but it just doesn't taste the same. So he calls the waiter, and he says, I don't know what's different. I don't know what's wrong. But it was... He said, yeah. He said, today you asked for kosher. He said, what? He said, yeah, there isn't Paris, there aren't kosher restaurants. We can prepare kosher, but you didn't ask for kosher yesterday. So it wasn't kosher yesterday. And he gets terribly upset and he goes to see his brother, the Aruch HaShulchan. It's a very interesting story. But one of the really interesting parts of the story my brother mentioned to me, because we're both reading the book, and he said, isn't it interesting that the waiter couldn't see from the way he was dressed that he was frum? Imagine a frum person going into a restaurant that serves kosher and non-kosher. They know what frum people look like. Are they going to serve treif to a guy who comes in who's clearly frum? So now you understand what it is. It says they looked like goyim. They dressed meticulously, they dressed beautifully. A businessman came in. That's all that they knew. There was a businessman who came in to sit down. You couldn't tell. And my father telling me that when Rebellia told him, his uncle, that he's seeing, when he was a young boy, he's seeing Rabbi Yisrael Salanter in the distance from behind, changed his life. And my father asking Rebellia, what did he look like? What was it about him? You saw him as you were a young boy, and you saw him in the distance from behind? What changed your life? And Rebellia said, because I knew what Rabbi Yisrael Salanter was. I'd heard all the stories, knew the man of gigantic Torah stature. And he looked like an ordinary businessman. That's what changed my life. So that whole idea in Lithuania of there was nothing on the outside that could indicate what was on the inside, other than nobility, other than refinement. And so I said, they dressed well, they dressed beautifully, they behaved beautifully. They were like the elite of society. But there was nothing that shouted from the outside as to who they were or what. That was all inside. You had to get inside to discover that gem. That was the Lithuanian tradition, and it was based on Hatznei Aleches. The Vilna Gaon writes in the very beginning of Shulchan Aruch. Oh my goodness, this recording isn't working. Bob, is your recording reliable? Is it working? Will I be able to get a copy? Okay, so then I'll just keep going and rely on yours. Thank you. The Vilna Gaon writes in the beginning of Shulchan Aruch that anything that one can possibly do, bitznius, anything that you can do that is hidden, that people don't have to see, that's the better way to do it. There should be nothing obvious. And it's very difficult because we live in a society and we live in a time where things are very vulgar. Where we feel a necessity to make statements all the time. And the idea of tzniut is the opposite, not to make a statement. To allow for discovery, that's what tzniut really is to allow somebody to discover you, if they want to. And if they don't want to, that's fine. But they don't have to. And you don't have to be discovered. The need to be, to in a vulgar way, put yourself out there and say to everybody who and what you are, that's something that was very foreign. So when he says, lo ayu yodim derech tzniut, that's altogether lavchin ben tov l'ra, because tznius only applies when you understand that in every good there is also evil, and in every evil there is good. There's a mixture. Then you need tznius to kind of separate it out. But if there's no understanding of that merging of good and bad, then you don't need tznius. Vafal pishenitna bo dea likrot shemot, even though they were given the power, the wisdom, to give names to all the animals. Lo natan bo yetzer hara, there was no internal yetzahara. There was no attraction to anything negative. So before the eating from Eitz Hadat, if something was wrong, it was unattractive. If something was destructive, it was unattractive. There was no attraction to something which was inherently bad. And there was enormous attraction to that which was inherently good. After eating from the Eitz Hadas, you get the Eitz Hara is introduced, which means man now has an ability to be attracted to that which is not good, which is why you need snus. Man has the ability to find pleasure in things that are not constructive, to find pleasure in things that are not healthy, whether physically healthy or spiritually healthy. Before the time of the Eitz Hadas, that wasn't possible. So that's the first understanding of it. So how does that then go wrong? Then what happens as a result of that? So the next thing is that the Hanachash now comes along and he uses his powers to ingratiate himself and to establish connection and relationship with Chava. But to understand how that happens, let's go one step deeper into the meaning of Vayushnehem Arumim. So I said to you, Targum Unkelus translates the way we translate it. The two of them were naked and they were not ashamed. The Targum Yoinoson translated a little differently. And he says, Vahavu Tarvehun Chakimin, Odom Vintate. Odom and his wife were incredibly brilliant. They were very, very wise. Orum also means wisdom, as we see in the next sentence. that Orma also is a form of wisdom. And that's how he translates. They were very wise, not that they were naked. That's not what it is. So what does v'lo yitboshashu mean? Well, the word boshesh can mean one of two things. It could come from the word busha, which is strange because busha, the root for busha is bet shin hey. And what is the root of this word here, v'lo yitboshashu, bet shin shin. So they're actually different roots. So to read it the simple way that it's translated by Unkelus and everybody else, including the English translation, v'lo yitboshashu, and they were not ashamed, actually is a bit of a push, it's a bit of a stretch, because yitboshashu is not the root of busha. With a bit of a stretch, you can say it. There's a school of thought that a Hebrew root is two letters, not three letters. In that case, you could say betshin is the root of busha, and it's the root of yitboshashu. But if you're looking at a three-letter root and you're saying bet shin shin, then boshash means something else. It means delay. It means tarry. It means remain. As it says that the time that Moshe comes down from Har Sinai, it says the people saw ki boshesh Moshe, that Moshe was taking his time. He didn't come down at the allotted time. He was taking too long. So the word boshesh can mean delay. So that's how the Targum Yonason translates it. V'lo amtinu bikarehon, and they couldn't maintain their glory. Now this is fascinating because it translates very well. Now we also understand the use of the words, two words, arum. So they were very brilliant, and the Nachash was the most brilliant of animals. That's fine. Now those two words link together in more than just the letters. They actually link together in meaning. And the word yitboshesh now means what it says. It means remain, retain. It doesn't mean shame. But what's really fascinating about the Targum Yonason is that then the Targum Yonason would be giving us the trigger of the fall. What is the Targum? So how does this verse now read? The two of them were brilliant, Adam and Ishto, and his wife, and they couldn't retain it. Which seems to suggest it was their very brilliance that made it impossible for their return to retain their glory. How is that possible? What does it mean? What does that mean? So here I'm going to try and explain to you something that is so crucial in the difference between a Torah approach to Torah and a, you know, I don't want to say a modern approach because that's such a difficult word. And the Torah itself, as you'll see, there's such modernity in Torah. But I call it a secular approach. And the truth is that in a lot of modern orthodoxy, there's secularity. A lot of modern orthodoxy is a secular approach to the keeping of mitzvahs. But it's not a Torah approach. And it's important to understand the differences. And I'm not saying that therefore we should not be modern, and we should not. I'm just saying that the term modern orthodoxy, which covers a very great spectrum of styles and people, so it's not a very useful term altogether. But within that philosophy of what we today call modern orthodoxy, there is an approach, there's an observance and a connection with Torah. It doesn't mean because we observe Torah that our approach is a Torah approach. It doesn't mean that because we study the Torah that our study of the Torah is a Torah approach. You can study your Torah in universities. What's interesting is I was looking at this Targum Yonason, for example, and I found an English translation of the Targum Yonason from the 19th century by a guy called Etheridge. And he translates this, V'lo amtinu bikarehon, V'lo amtinu, Aleph mem taf yud nun vav. He translates this, and they were not faithful to their glory, from the word emet. That's fine, except he doesn't know the Medrash. Where the Medrash, in clear reference to the Targum Yonason, although it doesn't mention it, talks about boshesh as himtinu. Omar Rabbi Eliezer says the Medrash in Parsha Yudchet, shlosha hen shelo himtinu b'shalvatan shesh shaot. There were three people who couldn't stay for 6 hours in their state of glory. Ve'elohein, Adam. Adam is one of them. Adam sheneema lo yitboshashu. So you see, the Medrash is translating lo yitboshashu as lahamtin. So when the Yonatan ben Uziel says v'lo amtinu, clearly he means they didn't retain. Not that they weren't faithful. So you've got, well, my point here is, you don't have to be, the fact that you're studying Torah Gaon Yonasan doesn't mean you're an Orthodox Jew. You could be a Christian academic. It doesn't mean anything. And the fact that you're a modern Orthodox person in yeshiva doesn't mean you're studying Torah with the Torah approach. It doesn't necessarily mean it. The fact you're the Haredi person also doesn't mean that you're doing it. There's no external label that can determine whether you're approaching it with Torah or you're approaching it from a secular angle. It's got nothing to do with labels. It's got to do with methodology. Is your methodology a Torah methodology or is your methodology a secular methodology? And I'm going to explain to you the difference. The difference is very profound. And then you'll see right away, you'll see the differences. The Medrash says in the beginning of Parsha Yutes, beginning of the 19th section, on this Vahanachash Haya Arum, he quotes a posuk from Kohelet, the beginning of Kohelet, Ki berov chokhma rav kas. Because with a great deal of knowledge comes a great deal of anger. Not your own anger, but anger from God. In other words, be careful of brilliance. The Yosef Dat, Yosef Machov. And the more you know, the more you suffer. Now what does all that mean? Al yedei she'adam marbe alav chochmo, hu marbe alav kas, val yedei she'mosif das, u'mosif alav machov. What does that mean? So the Tiferet Tzion explains the Medrash. And in the explanation of the Medrash, you'll understand the difference between a Torah approach to Torah and the secular approach to Torah. What triggers, what initiates action? Knowledge or belief? At the end of the day, those are the two things that can initiate action. Either you do something because you have an intuitive belief, you have an intuitive drive to do it. And I'm talking about positive action. I'm not talking about the Yetzer Hara and instinct and so on. I'm just talking about doing a mitzvah. If you're going to do a mitzvah, why would you be doing a mitzvah? Either you have knowledge, which triggers that, or you have emunah. And there's a very big difference between whether and of course we have both. You've got to have Torah, you've got to have knowledge, and you've got to have emunah. But if we try and unpack that a little bit more and say, and which one actually triggers your actions? Here's the difference. The one approach is wisdom. Explain the halacha to me. Show me where it comes from. Show me its origin. Explain its reason to me, and I'll keep it. The other is, I'll keep it. That's the way I was raised. There's no question about it. That's the way I was raised. I was brought up that way. Why do you keep Shabbos? I keep Shabbos because I've kept Shabbos for the last 5,000 years. Well, why wouldn't I be keeping Shabbos? Why do you keep kashrus? Because that's how I'm brought up. That's what I've always done. That's what my family's always done. That's what we've all always done. That's why I keep kashrus. That's right. It's true. It's the way for a Jew to be. But does that mean that I don't want to study Torah and go into the reasons for it and where it comes from and what its origins and learn Masechta Chulin? Sure I do. Learn Masechta Shabbos. Learn Masechta Sukkah. Of course I do. But what happens when a Torah Jew learns Torah? What is it for? What does it do? It doesn't make him frumer. It doesn't make him do more. It makes him believe deeper. And the belief makes him do more. Do you follow the difference? It goes through the heart. It doesn't go from brain to action. The secular approach is from brain to action. Prove it to me, and I'll do it. Bring me the data, and I'll do it. Give me the source. Give me the origin. Explain to me the reason, and I'll do it. That's secular. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm not making a judgment of good and bad. I'm just saying what is Torah and what is secular. So a secular approach would be, give me the data, give me the empirical sources and evidence, and that's fine. And if you look at a lot of the modern day shiurim, think about the shiurim you hear. How much of them are based on data and information? Laying out the data, this is the background, this is the source, this is where it comes from. Then it was this, then the Rambam says this, and this one says this, and this one says that, the Shulchan Aruch paskens this, the Mishnah Berurah asks this, Rav Moshe Feinstein answers that, and that's why we do it. Is that not the kind of, a lot of the kind of, and some of it is brilliant and beautiful and very important. Again, I'm not making a value judgment on it. But that methodology is not a Torah methodology. That methodology is a secular methodology. That's how you would present it at university. If you were giving a lecture at university on that topic, that's exactly how you would do it. That's not the traditional Torah way of doing it. The traditional Torah way of doing it is to take you deeply and existentially into God's thinking process. So when you come out of the shiur, it's not, now I know, Mishnah Berurah, Moshe Feinstein, that's why I did it. No. It's just you feel it so powerfully inside you that you do it with a different kind of commitment and a different kind of passion. Do you follow the difference that I'm trying to explain? It's very difficult to appreciate unless you've experienced it. But when you swear Limud HaTorah, the purpose of Limud HaTorah is not to gain information. The purpose of Limud HaTorah, the study of Torah, is to gain intimacy with God. Because you're in conversation with God. When you're studying Torah, you're in conversation with God. Not only are you in conversation with God, there was a beautiful piece that's on YouTube of Rabbi Yosher Ber Soloveitchik giving a talk at a Bris Milah. I don't know if any of you saw that, and if not, you should search for it. It was a Bris, and he was already very old when he gave this talk, and it's short. And he talks about the generation gap. He's a man in his 80s, probably mid-80s or more at that time, I don't remember exactly, giving a talk at a Bris. And he's talking about generation gap. And he talks about what happens in a shir, when he's giving a shir to a young schoolboy, and young people are sitting in the class, what actually is happening? And he talks about the boy asks a question. And who's he asking the question to? Who's he asking the question on? He's asking the question on Abaye Verova, two Amoraim, two characters in the Gemara that lived, you know, 2,000 years ago nearly. And then there'll be a conversation. And a Rambam will walk into the room. And he'll disagree with a Rashba. And the child will ask a question. And then Reb Chaim Soloveitchik will walk into the room. And he'll answer the child's question. This interaction is taking place. So when you're learning Torah, you're not only engaging in dialogue with God, you're engaging in dialogue with Torah history. You're engaging with dialogue with everything that's been discussed since Sinai. You're reconnecting with the whole debate since Sinai. It's all coming into one theater. Imagine that all coming to one room. I don't know if there's another study where that happens, because usually when you study a period. Usually when you study the latest views, the latest thoughts, certainly if you're in the area of science. But in Torah, you study everybody. It's as if everybody that's ever lived since Sinai, and before, because you've got the Chumash too, but let's just take since Sinai. Everybody comes into the room with you. And you're having this conversation about a topic. And you're trying to figure out how God sees the subject. That's what you're talking about. How does God see the world? How does God understand the issue? And who are you talking to? You're not talking to some young guy or to some older guy. You're talking to the greatest authorities of Torah thinking, some of the greatest minds that ever lived. You're engaging in debate with them. That's what happens when you're learning Torah. And what's the result of that? The result of not so now I know what I must do. I can't eat fish with my fork in this way and pull the bones out. That's not what it's about. What it's about is just I'm in a different space of intimacy with Hashem, with the Jewish people, and with the Torah. So my connection to the keeping of the mitzvahs is an entirely different one. That's what Torah methodology is. Torah methodology is not information triggering action, it's learning triggering emunah, and emunah triggering action. And that, says the Tiferet Zion, is the difference between kol shechochmasoi meruba mimaisov, chochmaso miskayemes. That if one's chochma is kol shemaisov meruba michochmaso, chochmaso miskayemes. If your deeds are greater than your wisdom, that's what this medrash means, says the Tiferet Zion. That your deeds need to be greater than your wisdom. Your deeds need to have an independent dynamic. The reason you keep what you keep is because that's part of who you are. It comes from deep inside you. The knowledge that comes with it is a different piece. That feeds you and that nourishes you and that drives you. But that's not the source of why you do things. Why you do things comes from something very deep inside you. And that's really important, because if you think about it, as much data as you may have on any topic, how much certainty can you have about anything? The truth is you can't have certainty about anything. You've got data and the data changes tomorrow. You've got a view and the view changes tomorrow. New information comes tomorrow. You think you understand a piece of if you halacha even, you learn the Shulchan Aruch, and you learn the Shulchan Aruch 6 months time, and it means something differently to you. How do you ever know where you are if you're using data and knowledge and information as the driver of action? So you can only act based on assumptions. You can make assumptions about reality, and you use data to inform assumptions, or you use emunah, or you use belief. And what do you think gives you more sense of certainty? Assumptions or belief? We like to call it knowledge. We think it's information, but it's not. It's not knowledge and information. We can't possibly have knowledge and information because it's always changing. It's dynamic. What can we be certain of? What do we really know for sure? How much can we really know for sure? So most of it is assumptions or emunah, beliefs. And our beliefs are more powerful in terms of certainty than assumptions. Now, not in the secular world. If we go back to the two methodologies, in the Torah world, a deed driven by emunah, supported by knowledge, but driven by emunah, is a much more robust deed than a deed driven only by knowledge and information. Now, what's all this got to do with our parasha here? So, Adam and Chava are very intellectual. They're very wise. They have wisdom. So what is the Nachash going to use to penetrate the armor of Chava as he attacks us? So let's have a look and see what he does. So he says, Vayomer in verse 1, Vayomer Eloisho, Afki Amarokim Loitechlu Mikol Eitz Hagon. Did Hashem say you're not allowed to eat from any of the trees in the garden? So he engages her. Makes an outrageous comment that calls for a response. No, not at all. Hashem's not unreasonable. We can eat from all the trees of the garden. Just to mipri ayisa shebetoch hagan amar elokim, lo tochlu mimenu velo tigu bo pentemutun. Do not eat from it nor touch it, lest you die. Now, of course, we see here, and we'll come back to it, that she adds, we're not allowed to touch it either, although God has not said that. Ve'yomer anachash shel ha'ish ha'lo mutamutim. Not true. Ki yoda elokim ki v'yom achalchem imenu v'nifkichu enechem v'yitim ki elokim yodea tov v'ra. Hashem is just a little insecure. He understands. This is, after all, the tree of knowledge of good and bad. If you eat from this, you'll know as much as he does. Who wants that? Of course God doesn't want you to know as much as he wants. So what is he using? What is the snake using to undermine Chava? He's using intellect. And that's the difficulty with a Judaism, an involvement with Yiddishkeit, that is based on knowledge and information. Every new little bit of knowledge and information, or any suggestion by somebody who might be able to manipulate knowledge and information better than you, who might be brighter than you, or might know more than you, allows you to be shaken and to be moved off. The moment you start off with the reason for kashrus is this, or the reason for Shabbos is that, you immediately open yourself to adulteration. You immediately open yourself to say, well, that doesn't apply anymore today. This isn't this, isn't that. That starts immediately. So if you start looking at halacha through a secular lens, that's exactly what happens. Chava, or let's say the Nachash to start with, was the quintessential intellectual kind of, you know, I don't want to give labels, reform, conservative, modern orthodox, but using intellect to rationalize halacha. That's what he's doing. That's all he's doing. And right in the beginning of the Torah, in chapter 3, the Torah warns us, what happens if you go that route? What happens if you take halacha and you approach it intellectually? Of course you approach halacha intellectually in the learning of halacha, but not in the keeping of halacha. That's the difference. The keeping of halacha comes from emunah. The learning of halacha comes from your intellect. That's exactly what it has to be. And today it's kind of gotten switched around. The keeping of halacha is from your mesorah. It's from your tradition. It's from the way you are. It's from deep inside your neshama. That's where it comes from. That's why you do it. That's why you had Jews who were, if you look at some of the stories, I'm reading a book at the moment, that part of which takes place during the Second World War in the Kovno ghetto, and you look at the mesiras nefesh of these people to keep halachic detail in those circumstances. They didn't have to. That wasn't necessary. Their lives were threatened every moment, and the way they kept kashrus, when all they had to eat was horse meat, that's all they were given, and they kept hilchos kashrus. They built mikvahs in the Warsaw Ghetto, in the Kovna Ghetto when this was going on. They used to go to shiurim, they used to put on tefillin early in the morning. They used to have to go out to work. It was before dawn. So they used to put on tefillin before dawn. They going out to work under Nazi supervision. They designed berets to cover their shel rosh. And while they were working, the beret guys, they used to call them, used to gather together and work in the same band and daven with a minion under the Nazis' nose, and the Nazis didn't know. Saying Kedusha, Shmoneh Esrei, Chazoros HaShatz, everything, every single morning. And then they would take their tefillin off secretly and put them in their pockets. And this went on for several years. Did they have to do that? They could have argued, we're unmuslim, what can you do? We're being forced, we don't have freedom. Absolute meticulous observance of halacha. And when they came back from that back-breaking work every day, what did they do? They could come back, like we do, and say, phew, hard day's work, shiur tonight. Just don't have koach. They went and they taught daf yomi to the children. That's what they did when they came home. To make sure that the next generation kept their Yiddishkeit. And on Shabbos, what did they used to do? They used to go to a shmuz in Rav Avrom Grudzinski's house. He used to be the mashkiach of Slabodka before the war. And he used to give a shmuz. He used to give a musa shmuz on Shabbos. The one day they could rest. No, they would all gather at Rav Avrom Grudzinski's house. This went on. 1941, 42, 43. Until the end of it. Where does that come from? Because they're rationalizing? If their halachic observance was driven by halachic by rational criteria, they could easily have rationalized, don't have to do it. We're not obligated. Oines Rachmana Patra. It's quite simple. But their hearts didn't allow them to give up. That wasn't possible. And the person that I'm reading about, Reb Motel Pagamansky, which we've spoken about, I think, previously, used to just say to them all the time, stay connected to halacha. Stay connected to halacha. Because halacha is the only thing that keeps you connected with God every second of every day. But that's not rational. That's emotional. That's emuna. When you start rationalizing halacha, you can rationalize when you're learning Gemara. You can rationalize as much as you want to. You have to rationalize when you learn Gemara. You're trying to understand a Tosfos. You've got to use every bit of your analytical ability. You've got to be critical. You've got to question. You've got to reject. You've got to create. You've got to be mechadish. That's how you learn Gemara. But if you start doing that in the observance of halacha area, then you get into the Nachash debate with Chava. So why does God really tell? Never thought that that might be the reason. If that's the reason, then it's not the end of the world. On the contrary, I want to be bright and clever like God. God surely wouldn't mind that much. And I'll be careful not to stand on his toes and not to offend him. So now you start the whole thing. It's good to eat. God wouldn't create something good to eat if it was bad. Don't forget, she doesn't yet understand good and bad coming together in one thing. And it's good for the eyes. It gives you insight. That's what tovalu leinayim means. It doesn't mean that it's pretty. V'tzachita avalu leinayim, say Chazal, it gives you insight. V'nechmada eitz lahaskil, and it gives you wisdom. V'atikach mipirio v'atoichil, and she eats. So what does the Nachash do? And the Nachash uses another trick, says Chazal. The Nachash pushes her against the tree and shows her that nothing will happen if you touch the tree. You said that if you touch the tree, you'll die. Look, you touch the tree and you're still alive. Nothing happened. It's fine. That's like the person will say, you know what? So be mechallel Shabbos once. Let's see if lightning strikes you. See? Nothing happened. So it's all nonsense. So get modern. Get with it already. When you start that way, there's no end. You lose everything. There's nothing left. It's the end of everything. When you intellectualize halacha, when you approach halacha academically, when you use modernity to... As the driver of your halacha, there's no halacha left. Halacha is not modern. Halacha is the same halacha that Moshe gave us on Sinai. There's nothing modern about that. It's ancient. Really ancient. Nothing modern. We've got to apply it to modern circumstances. That's why we have poskim. But there's nothing modern about halacha. It's the one thing we've got that is ancient. You want modernity? Learn a Tosfos. And innovate when you're learning. You want modernity? Learn a Rambam and find a new approach to the Rambam. Get into the learning of Torah and you can be as modern as you want. But when it comes to halacha, there's no modernity. When it comes to halacha, you link back to the way the Torah was given at Sinai as much as you can, considering the current world in which you operate. So when I say we don't want modernity in halacha, I'm not saying we want to become, look and act like ancient people. No. We want to be engaged in the modern world, but not through any kind of compromise of halacha and the belief system that drives halachic observance, because halachic observance needs to be driven by a belief system and not by anything else. And that's why it's so important how one raises one's children. If we raise our children to keep halacha because we prove it to them and tell them the reasons and they understand the philosophies, we've lost it. We've lost that generation. They have to be able to see their parents committed to halacha. When they see their parents committed to halacha, it's something they feel. They've got to feel it in the home. They've got to feel the joy. They've got to feel the connection. They've got to feel the intimacy with halacha. They've got to see and feel its importance. That's what keeps the next generation going. Otherwise, we produce a next generation of secular religious people. Religious doesn't mean you're not secular. Religious just means you observe. But there's a difference, as we're saying, between observing from a place of emunah and observing from a place of intellect. Very big difference. And Chava starts there. The other problem that happened as a result of this is that Chava is missing some data. And that's part of the problem when everything's driven by intellect. So again, if my halacha, if my shmiras hamitzvahs, if my keeping of the mitzvahs is driven by my emunah and my mesorah, my tradition, what happens if I'm missing some information? If I don't know every detail of the halacha, it's not going to make a difference, because that's not the source of why I keep it. I keep the halacha the way my father did. I keep the halacha the way my mother did. I keep the halacha. There's a beautiful Meiri. When the Meiri writes in one of his tshuvas that some frum people came to his shul. It's another Meiri, a Rishon, the great Meiri. He says some frumis came to his shul and they started objecting to the way he paskens and saying that that's not religious enough. And one of the things they objected to is the way the women check the beans before they make the chant on Shabbos. And they want them to check every bean and to hold them up to the light. And he says, I don't know anything about that. I just know how my mother used to do it. And my mother used to put it in water, and the ones that floated to the top she got rid of, and the ones that sank were the good ones. And I know that that's how her mother did it, and her mother, and her mother, ad soro imenu. And that's how soro did it. That's what I know. And they'll come, the new guys come along, they learned in yeshiva all sorts of new things about why that's not good enough and it has to be done this way and not that way. They're using data, they're using information. That's not what drives halacha. What drives halacha is mesorah. What drives halacha is how did our ancestors do it? And that's what we've got to be able to try and recover, and that's what we've got to be able to try and grasp. Because if you use data and information as your source, what happens if your data is incomplete? Which it's bound to be. Who knows everything about any halacha? So if you're going to use data, in any case, you're going to be missing stuff. And Chava was missing something. And that was Adam's fault. Adam underestimated her. When Adam told her the din, when Adam taught her Hilchas Shabbos, he taught her that you taught her Hilchas Eitz Hadas, he taught her that you can't touch the tree either. Why did he do that? Says the Medrash and obviously Rabbi Nosson, he made the first Gezeirah. This was the first Gezeirah de Rabbonin. You know, people say, how do the rabbis come? And it says in the Torah this, why not that as well? It says you can't write. Why must the rabbi say you can't touch things? Can't touch a pen? It's Muktzah. Why must we make laws upon laws? It started already at Adam. He was the first one who did it. He's not criticized for doing it. That was the right thing to do. He was worried. He thought, you know what? Let's not even touch the tree. If we don't touch the tree, it's more likely that we're not going to come to eat from the tree. So that was a takona. What he's criticized for is not telling her that that was a takona. He should have said to her, God said don't eat. I, chief rabbi of the earth, am saying don't touch. That's a takona of the Chazal. That's a rabbinic takona. Then what would have happened when the snake pushed her against the tree and nothing happened? She would have said, of course nothing happened. That's just the takon. My husband made that law. That isn't what God said. But she was missing that piece of information. Not for any bad reason. Adam just didn't tell it to her that way. He thought it would have more effect if she thought it was all part of God's instruction. But that was false. It wasn't true. And her lack of that piece of information, of that knowledge, caused her to buy into the Nachash's argument. Had she had all the information, it would have worked. So what do we see? Information is fine if you've got it all. But since you never have it all, information is what is not what is not what should drive it. So when the let's go back to the Targum Yonasan. So what does the Targum Yonasan say? That Adam and Chava were Hakimin, they were very wise, they were intellectuals. V'loy amtinu bikareyon, and that was the cause for them not being able to retain their status. That caused them to lose their glory because they bought into the intellectual argument. Their approach to Torah at that time, the approach to that one law, was an intellectual approach. They didn't have a Messiah yet. They didn't have a tradition. They didn't have, there was nothing that they had yet. All they had was the knowledge of what God told them. And that was the flaw built into the system. Isn't it amazing? Wisdom, the driver of the world and the driver of Torah, was the very flaw in the system that caused Adam's downfall. Let's go a little further. What about Chava? So Chava uses, remember last week we talked about the role of the woman, man and woman in that relationship, and how woman is designed as providing the conditions of service for a man, that a man has now has someone and something to serve and to love, and how important that is in the man's life. And if you look at the words in the pasuk, after she eats, vatikach mipirio vatachal, she takes from the fruit of the tree and she eats, vatitain gam leisha ima, and she gave also to her husband with her. It was using their intimacy, using the ima, the fact that he trusted her, that she used to get him to eat, vayochal, and he ate. I want to look at the consequence of their eating. And before I do look at the consequence of their eating, I want to ask you to do a few exercises. If you have pencil and paper, all the better. If you don't, you can do it in your head. I want you to do a few exercises. One exercise is, think of some of the things you would have loved to have done but have not. Think of three. Think of three things you would have loved to have done and have not. Right? I'm giving you a moment to think of them. Think of three things you would have loved to have done in your life but haven't done.
Love or should have?
Either. Should have. Would you look back and say, I would have wanted to. Would have wanted to do. Didn't. And now, question those three things, go through those three things and check how many of them did you not do because of fear of something? And I would suggest that if you think through them carefully, you'll find that they were all not done because of fear of something. Afraid you wouldn't succeed, afraid you wouldn't have the money to do it, afraid you would have to give up something else to do it, afraid you might make a fool of yourself doing it, afraid you might disappoint somebody else who's expecting something different from you. If you look at it carefully, you're likely to find that the things that hold us back, that the emotion that holds us back from doing things we want to do, is fear. Now look at the things you have accomplished. Think of three of the things that you've accomplished in your life, that you're proud of. And ask yourself, how many of those things might not have been accomplished if you had no fear? How many of those things did you do because you feared not having money, not being able to support your family, not having this, not having that, not being able to do this? How many of them, if you look deeply, how many of the things you have accomplished were also driven by fear, different fears? And again, I would suggest that you're likely to find that many of the things you didn't do but would have wanted to do, you didn't do because of fear. And many of the things you did do and accomplish, you did because of fear. Do one further thing. Think of three things that you fear the most. Think of three of your biggest fears. And then consider two things about those. The first thing is, how many of those things that you fear entail fear of loss? Loss of life, loss of health, loss of a loved one, loss of family, loss of money, loss of material possessions, loss of something. And again, I would suggest that most of what we fear, is the fear of loss. In fact, I would suggest, we don't have time to discuss that, but I'm happy to discuss it with you at another time, is that that's virtually the only fear that we have, if not the only fear we have. The only fear we have is fear of loss. There's nothing else we fear. Just a fear of loss. And the last thing is, think about your biggest fears. How many of the things you fear most have ever actually happened? And I would suggest that mostly you will find that the things you fear have never happened. So now just think about fear. Fear, without fear, we wouldn't have achieved a whole lot of the things we did achieve. But without fear, we would have achieved a whole lot of things we wish we would have achieved. And fear is in our head because most of the things we fear never happen. And in fact, all we fear is loss. So, my first question tonight was, what went wrong? My second question is, so what happened? What was the consequence of what went wrong? And I would suggest the consequence was the introduction of fear into the world. That's all, fear of loss. Because we lost Gan Eden. And that pain of losing Gan Eden was so deep that it's embedded in the DNA of every human being ever since to do whatever they can not to lose anything again. Because the fear of loss is so painful. The experience of loss is so painful. So we have all experienced the loss in our DNA. We have all have historic and cultural memory of having lost the most precious experience available to the human being. We had it and we lost it. And we know what that feels like. And it is so painful that we'll do everything we can not to experience loss again. And therefore loss drives us, causes us not to do things because we're afraid of loss. And loss causes us to do things because we don't want loss. So the fear of loss becomes an incredibly powerful driver in the human being. What is another word for fear of loss in Jewish terminology? And you might be surprised. I consider the right word for the fear of loss, for that emotion, which is the fear of loss, Yetzirah. That's the Yetzirah. Yetzirah. That's the Yetzirah. As they translate as the evil inclination, which is a useless translation. Yetzirah is a creative force gone wrong. That's what Yetzirah is. Yetzirah means creative force. Ra means gone bad. Yetzirah is the creative force gone bad. When the creative force is driven by fear, whether that holds you back or that drives you forward, that's that fear which gives us the need to control. It's the fear which gives us the need for ego. It's the fear which gives us the need to create security, to pursue security, to hold on to security. So the quest for security, the human being's quest for security, is the biggest driver of human instinct, and that's the source of Yetzer Hara, which started right here. When they ate from the, it was even before they lost Gan Eden. When they ate from the eights, the Torah says that's the Arumim. They then noticed Vatipachna Eneshlim Vayeduki Arumimim. They knew that they were naked. Says Rashi, even a blind person knows they're naked. You don't have to open your eyes to know that you're naked. You can know that you're naked without your eyes being open. Elomau Vayeduki Arumimim, says Rashi. What does it mean that they knew they were naked? Mitzvah They only had one mitzvah, one way of being able to connect with God through halacha, and that was gone. Halacha was gone at that moment. That no more halacha. And imagine what that would be like. What would a Jew be like with no halacha? How do you connect to God? And that feeling of loss, it was the loss of halacha, and then, as a follow-up, the loss of Gan Eden. And we know what that feeling of loss is. That was the introduction of Yetzer Hara. Not wanting to ever feel loss again was the feeling of Yetzer Hara. That now, and I always argue that the quest for security is the driver of all the greatest of human accomplishments, and it's the driver of all the most terrible tragedies of human accomplishment as well. It's the same thing, and that's why Yetzer Hara, as we learned